University workers still don't know how much of a pay raise they might get. Good evening, I'm Courtney Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Jovetic, and Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Flathead reporter Katrin Fry tells us about a new way to raise chickens. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with the executive director of Missoula's Poverello Center about Missoula's growing homeless population. State workers are poised to receive their first base pay raises in more than 4 years. Governor Steve Bullock announced a deal this week with unions, detailing how $116 million provided by the legislature for pay hikes is going to be split up. The pay increases will go into effect starting the 1st of July, provided state agencies and the unions all ratify the deal. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us it's a different story for employees of the Montana University system.
Governor Steve Bullock's budget director, Dan Villa, says this pay deal is a long time coming.
It helps make up some lost ground. We value the work that our Montana state employees do to make sure that our economy continues to roll, maintaining our streets, ensuring public safety, and this raise is part of our commitment to that partnership.
Montana public employees voluntarily froze their wages in 2009 to help secure state funding as the recession started. They did then ask for a raise in 2011, which the legislature rejected. And lawmakers also rejected the first proposal for raises brought forward in 2013, a plan negotiated between unions and former Governor Brian Schweitzer and then supported by Governor Bullock. This plan would have given state employees a 5% raise each of the next 2 years. Instead, lawmakers cut a quarter of the funding from that plan and sent the remaining $116 million back to the governor's office for renegotiation with unions, putting special attention on low-income earners. Villa says the deal reached with the unions gives employees a 3% raise starting in July and then another 5% raise starting in November 2014. Villa describes it as a fair deal for the money they had, since it gives a raise as soon as possible.
But it also represents moving a date in the second year so that we can maximize the amount of money in the long term that goes into our employees' pockets.
Villa says the deal also honors legislators' request for greater emphasis on low-income earners through full funding of what they're calling the blue-collar pay plan. It's an increase of 92 cents an hour this year and 97 cents an hour in 2014 for workers like carpenters and other tradespeople. They are the only employee group whose pay raise plan did not get cut from what it was at the start of the legislature. But the big pay deal announced this week does not apply to the employees of Montana's public colleges and universities. Out of the $116 million total pay plan bill, $19 million went to the Montana University system for raises and benefit increases for roughly 5,000 employees. But the negotiations on how to divvy up that $19 million happened between the State Board of Regents and the 25 different employee unions in the university system. Those talks are still ongoing. Associate Commissioner of Higher Education Kevin McCray says the $19 million is also not as much as they were originally expecting, but he says the university system is grateful.
It is, in our view, a meaningful appropriation that will allow us to pursue some meaningful improvements in compensation for faculty and staff.
McCray says they will try to get close to the size of raises reached by the governor's office, but they will not be able to get all the way there.
We always are funded a little bit differently than typical executive branch agencies. That's always the case. It is again.
He says the regents may also pursue using some of the money given for recruitment and retention efforts. McCray expects university negotiations with the different unions to last through much of the summer. He says whatever the university system raises end up being, they will likely not go into effect until the beginning of October. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
And in other news from around the state, emergency officials say counties and reservations in northern and central Montana are estimating the flooding damage to roads, culverts, and bridges at $2.85 million. Governor Steve Bullock has declared an emergency for 15 counties and two reservations after 2 weeks of rain that produced more precipitation in some areas see in a normal year. Department of Military Affairs spokesman Major Timothy Crow said today 13 of the 17 local governments reported road damage. Crow says the $2.85 million estimate is based on that reporting, and further assessments are being conducted. The areas reporting the most damage are the Rocky Boys and Fort Belknap reservations, along with Hill and Blaine counties. Crow says there are no injuries or families requiring shelter. The counties and tribes are assessing the damages to homes.
A 38-year-old Thompson Falls woman was killed in a single vehicle rollover on U.S. Highway 2 near Kalispell. The Flathead Beacon reports Flathead County officials identified the woman as Amber Morgan McAtee. The Montana Highway Patrol says McAtee was westbound at about 3 p.m. yesterday when her sport utility vehicle went off the left side of the road about 7 miles west of Kalispell. She overcorrected and put the SUV into a side slide, which caused it to roll. The patrol says McAtee was ejected from the vehicle and ended up pinned underneath it in a ditch.
A state judge has ruled an immigrant rights group's challenge of voter-approved law can be heard. District Judge Jeffrey Sherlock ruled yesterday the Montana Immigrant Justice Alliance was within its rights to file the lawsuit because the initiative was designed to affect its members. The law requires proof of citizenship or legal standing from applicants for state services. If an applicant can't prove legal status, the state agency is required to give that person's name to immigration authorities. The alliance says the law would unfairly harm people who entered the country illegally but have since gained legal status. State attorneys asked Sherlock to dismiss the case, saying nobody has been injured or threatened by the law. Sherlock dismissed two other plaintiffs' claims but allowed the alliance's challenge to go forward.
A conference designed for Montana healthcare professionals wanting to better understand how to connect with veterans and their families takes place tomorrow physically in Helena and simulcasts remotely to sites around the state. The Citizen Soldier, the Invisible Wounds of War conference is hosted by the Western Montana Area Health Education Center at the University of Montana and the North Central Area Health Education Center. These centers, commonly referred to as AHEC, promotes and raises awareness about a variety of rural healthcare issues. Program coordinator Anna Buckner says tomorrow's Citizen Soldier Professional Education program is the fourth in a series.
What we do during the conference is share information about not only topics veterans and people in the military often suffer from, including post-traumatic stress disorder, traumatic brain injury, military sexual trauma. So we cover all that, and we talk about military culture. And so we do that so the people attending become more familiar with maybe people, you know, identifying people who are veterans and kind of what their specific needs are.
Buckner says it's really a mental health conference, which explains the title, The Invisible Wounds of War.
When people come into a healthcare provider, whether that is a counselor or another type of therapist, or whether that's just a primary care provider, the issues that they are suffering from aren't always readily apparent. And so I really think that's kind of what it means by invisible. And so part of the conference is really getting people to learn to ask their patients if they're veterans, which is really important.
90% of soldiers survived their injuries now, but as of September of 2009, mental health problems were the second most common health problems among soldiers returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. The lead psychologist at the Southern Arizona Veterans Administration Healthcare System in Tucson will be tomorrow's principal conference speaker. It says it will be held at Helena St. Peter Hospital and also broadcast to distant sites across the state, including Billings, Wolf Point, Missoula, and Glendive.
A Pennsylvania doctor on a guided fishing trip in southwestern Montana went home with an amazing tale of hauling a 25-pound lunker, a baby moose plucked from the rushing waters. Karen Shisha of Red Hill, Pennsylvania, a guide, Seth McClain, with Four Rivers Fishing Company, were fishing the Big Hole River on Saturday when they spotted a cow moose with a calf trying to cross the river. Shisha told the Missoulian that the mother moose struggled to cross, and when her calf tried to follow, it was swept away. They followed downstream, finally spotting the tiny moose's nose just above the water. Shisha says she scooped the moose out of the water, and McLean rowed the raft upriver so they could return the calf to her mother.
Pastured poultry is a method of raising chickens or turkeys by giving them free range over the ground and the most natural life possible. Katrin Fry reports there's growing interest in this method in the state, but also some obstacles.
Agriculture economist Jeff Szczesinski with the National Center for Appropriate Technology, or NCAT, says pastured poultry is a method gaining interest across the country alongside the local food movement.
The idea is that to get them outside in the air, there it changes the quality we think of the meat and possibly the nutritional value of the meat. It lends itself to, you know, just the animal being healthier and happier to a certain extent, although they all end up in the pot.
NCAT has its headquarters in Butte and started in 1976 with the backing of Senator Mike Mansfield. Szczesinski says it does a lot of work in sustainable agriculture, renewable energy, and energy efficiency. He says the appropriate in its name doesn't mean using technology to operate on a large or small scale, but somewhere in between.
What is the appropriate scale that can be sustainable, that can match elements of being economically viable, can help the community, and it can be environmentally sound. So the sustainability and appropriate somewhat are the same basic idea, that there is a proper human scale to industry, that we should search for that.
NCAT teamed up with several other organizations to offer workshops on pastured poultry in Great Falls, Bozeman, down in the Bitterroot Valley, and in Ronan in the Mission Valley. Director Jan Tusick for the Mission Mountain Food Enterprise Center says her organization focuses on economic development for the agriculture sector. The center helps food and agriculture clients navigate regulatory issues, works with food cooperatives, coordinates farm-to-school programs, and offers a certified kitchen to prep fruits and vegetables. Tusick says challenges to raising chickens in Montana include having an available processing facility. There isn't one. Costs to small-scale farmers, and confusion about the rules and regulations guiding the industry.
There's a high demand for local poultry, but there are several barriers. One, of course, we talked about regulations. Feed cost was another barrier. Labor costs for doing on-farm processing of birds, doing those the labor was an issue.
A Hutterite colony in Montana that sells whole chickens has its own packaging plant, and Tusick says the center used to have access to a mobile processing machine, which is now out of service. She says they're working with farmers to pool their purchasing power to lower the cost of buying chicken feed. Another challenge of raising chickens in Montana is handling predators like grizzly bears. The Mission Valley itself has seen several cases of bears getting into chicken coops, killing chickens, and being relocated or killed themselves.
We should not be killing bears for chickens. You know what? If you live up in the mountains, you want to raise chickens, there's a certain reality check here. You might have your chickens eaten by a predator. And why we would destroy that predator because he ate someone's chickens is beyond me.
Part of the workshop discusses electric fencing and cost share programs available through Defenders of Wildlife to electrify and to build safe coops. Tusick says these workshops are an opportunity to educate people about what needs to be done to get into the business of raising chickens, but there's still a lot to be done on the regulatory side for the industry to take off in Montana. Can people, when you're doing these workshops, with the people that you're working with, would they be able to sell pastured poultry to me right now?
No. No. Not unless we get a 1,000 bird exemption standard in place and signed off by the Department of Livestock that will be interagency approved with the Department of Health and Human Services. So the county sanitarians are on board to allow that processing on farm.
Tusick and Szczesinski say through these workshops, they're exploring the interest that exists in raising pastured chickens for sale and identifying the next steps needed for the industry to develop. Katrin Fry reporting from the Flathead.
As we reported yesterday, Missoula officials hope to break ground for a new emergency soup kitchen and homeless shelter this fall. The current Pavarello Center is no longer adequate to serve the average 100 men and women who stay there overnight. The new $5 million center on West Broadway will offer both more room and more services. Executive Director Aaron Fowler-Payhan says they still need to raise $500,000 to reach their goal.
And that will come in a combination of private local foundation grants and direct gifts from community members who really are invested in the project and what it will do for the community.
And you're calling the campaign Help Build Hope, and that is because this is hope for a new facility that you sorely need.
Absolutely. We have been operating out of a boarding home that was built in the late 1800s since we started providing shelter services almost four decades ago. And so the need for the facility is well documented and very obvious for folks who've been inside of it. And really, our organization builds hope for men and women every day. We are the safe haven in this community for people who fall in hard times and find themselves homeless or living in poverty without food resources. And so sometimes that very basic first step of moving on to the next best option is having access to those basic needs of food and shelter.
I want to just read some statistics about the need. In 1981, your current facility, when it was occupied, you provided 4,800 nights of shelter and 15,000 meals. Last year, in the same building, you provided more than 25,000 nights of shelter and over 130,000 meals.
Yeah, we've seen in the last four decades, since we opened for services, we've seen about a 425% increase in the demand for food and shelter in our community. We really saw that spike in 2009 when the economy became difficult for many people, and we haven't seen that level off since then. And so we fear what we're serving now, about 100 men and women per night and about 365 meals a day, is our new norm for the foreseeable future. And we're working with the community on long-term efforts to address homelessness, but in the meantime, we need a dignified, accessible emergency facility to serve folks.
In terms of this new norm, the factors that go into someone becoming homeless are many, but a big part is it's just very hard to find affordable housing.
Absolutely. The populations that we serve at the Poverello Center are really as varied as the community we live in. About 30% of our shelter guests are discharged veterans of war. That's a growing population. We're also serving more and more first-time homeless, which, like you point out, are people who may have college degrees, who have very solid vocational skills, but after a layoff or just graduating from college are finding an incredibly difficult time.
Or medical emergency.
Absolutely. Acute medical needs, medical emergency. So the needs are just so very different and the barriers to finding housing. The one unifying factor that we do see is the lack of a safety net. Folks are estranged from family or disconnected from family. I think all of us know someone who would have been homeless at some point in time if not for a helping hand from a neighbor or a family member or a sibling. And so regardless of what other factors make housing difficult for people, that lack of a safety net and a support system is really paramount.
How much of a factor, Erin, is it that there isn't adequate mental health treatment available?
The lack of really comprehensive mental health care for all of our community members, those without access to insurance, and then addiction treatment are incredibly large factors in folks falling into homelessness. 45% of the people that we serve have a diagnosed disability. For many people, that might be a mobility impairment, a medical need. For the vast majority, it is a severe mental health disorder. And so that is a very important factor to look at when looking at addressing homelessness.
There was opposition and still is to the new location of the Poverello Center. No matter where you would locate it, there would be some opposition. And that's because people are afraid of having homeless people as their neighbor.
There's an incredible amount of stigma and fear around homelessness and what homelessness looks like. I think, unfortunately, it's easy for us to glob together all of the very diverse segments of folks who fall into homelessness and really identify them as what we see most visibly, the chronically homeless men and women. We know that that is less than 11% of Missoula's total homeless population. The other 89% are made up of families, veterans, people with health issues. And so it's really important for us to provide education about that. We have over 900 volunteers per year who spend time at the Poverello Center. And what's most telling to us is the concepts they have walking into the POV, and then how that vision changes when they leave. And they really see that the vast majority of people who become homeless are our neighbors who are just struggling and need a helping hand.
The new facility will offer services the current facility doesn't. For one thing, you'll have accessibility for disabled people, and there will also be other available services that you don't have now.
Yeah, one of our favorite things to say when we talk about the new building is the new POV will not be the old POV, and that is because we have so many programmatic limitations just based on the physical layout of the building we're in now. So in the new facility, we will have semi-private rooms for veterans of war. That's increasingly important as veterans come back with traumatic brain injury, post-traumatic stress disorder, and they just can't sleep in communal dorms. We'll also have spaces for women who are experiencing trauma, private spaces. We'll have medical respite rooms, which we don't have now. We're serving more and more people who come to us in hospice care and spend the last weeks or months of their lives at the Poverello Center. And we want to be able to provide as much dignity to those individuals as we can in those final days. We will have increased supportive services, more educational opportunities, vocational training, things we just can't do now. And when you have the space, you can really help people acquire the skills that they need to have more opportunities.
The city and county have a plan to end homelessness, a 10-year plan. It's ambitious. How does this new facility fit into that?
We really see the new facility as a linchpin in the 10-year plan to end homelessness. While we work towards long-term solutions, creating more affordable housing, looking at mental health treatment and addiction treatment services and availability of those, I'm really working to get people housed as soon as possible. We know that there will be a segment of the population that always falls into homelessness, and we need a really well-functioning, effective, and dignified facility to act as that safety net for folks. And so when we talk about ending homelessness, we do really want to work on a preventative level to eliminate the number of people that fall into homelessness. We also want to recognize that some people still will, and our goal is to get them rapidly rehoused as soon as possible. So while we might still serve the same number of people in the homeless shelter as we're serving now, our goal is to serve them and to get them housed within 15 days, within 20 days, as opposed to 90 days or 120 days, which we see some people staying with us now.
What do you say, Erin, to those who would say, if you build a bigger facility, Missoula will become a magnet for homeless people, that more homeless people will come here because there will be these new services?
Yeah, I think that's a common misperception. Missoula is such a compassionate and kind community. I think that folks assume that we serve more than our fair share of people down on their luck because of that. And the numbers tell us that's simply not true. So if you, you know, point on a map across the nation, you'll find that about 0.07% of any community's population find themselves homeless. And that's pretty consistent based on numbers from the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Missoula does serve a proportional amount of homeless individuals based on our population. We don't serve dramatically more than Billings or other communities of our size. And I think what that tells us is that the majority of folks falling into homelessness are our neighbors, our community members, folks from Missoula. And I don't think a new facility will cause us to serve more homeless men and women. I think what it will do is allow us to serve them better and allow us to get them housed faster, which will be better for everyone.
And you, of course, hope to break ground this fall and be in the new facility by winter?
Yeah, so our goal is to break ground in August or September of 2013 and to be operational in the new facility by the end of 2014.
I've been speaking with Erin Fowler-Pahan, who's executive director of the Poverello Center, and she's talking about the Help Build Hope campaign. They're still fundraising for the new center. Erin, best of luck with the new center, and thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
People who want more information about the new shelter and how to donate can go to this website, thepoverellocenter.org.
And in tonight's forecast, for west of the Continental Divide, tonight will be mostly cloudy with a slight chance of thunderstorms, lows in the upper 40s. Tomorrow will be mostly cloudy with a slight chance of showers, highs in the upper 70s to mid 80s. For central Montana, tonight will be partly cloudy, lows in the lower 50s. Tomorrow will have a chance of rain. There will be a chance of rain showers in the afternoon. Highs will be in the upper 70s. And for southwest Montana, tonight will have cloudy skies, then become partly cloudy. and have thunderstorms in the evening, lows in the upper 40s. Tomorrow will be cloudy with a slight chance of thunderstorms in the afternoon. Highs will be 75 to 85. And now for the editorial comments of Evan Barrett.
One has to wonder if Stillwater Mining's future was foreshadowed by the Anaconda Company's past. It's been said that those who do not learn from history are condemned to repeat it. It is now exactly 30 years ago that the last Anaconda Arco miner laid down his tools in Butte. Does that Montana economic disaster provide any lessons for Stillwater Mining today? In 1923, the Anaconda Copper Mining Company, we'll call it ACM, Montana's largest employer and the backbone of the state's economy, decided to chase cheap labor, buying mining properties in the Andes Mountains of Chile in South America in what was called the largest cash transfer that Wall Street had ever seen. What ensued for Montana was a multi-decades diminishing of Anaconda's operations here. They failed to adequately reinvest in their Montana properties as company cash flowed to South America. Then, in 1971, with unbelievable speed, the decline and fall came as the new leftist government of Chile seized and nationalized the Anaconda properties. In just 12 short years, by June of 1983, nearly 7,500 Montana ACM workers had been reduced to just 17 caretakers, oiling the hinges while waiting for a takeout buyer for the weakened company. That terrible chapter of Montana history was on the mind of many Montanans as former Governor Brian Schweitzer led a shareholder effort to save Stillwater Mining from its own bad boardroom decisions and, in the process, save thousands of Montana jobs. For those like me who lived through the ultimate death of ACM, the corporate misjudgments of Stillwater were hauntingly reminiscent of the mistakes of ACM as it fell from industrial giant to corporate takeover bait. The Stillwater Mining parallel to ACM is troubling. In 2010, while Stillwater was profiting from its unique Montana platinum and palladium ore bodies and employing nearly 2,000 highly skilled, highly paid Montanans, its board authorized the start of a foreign buying binge, spending over $100 million on various properties in eastern Canada. Then, in mid-2011, Stillwater started putting money, now over $500 million worth, into a mining property in Argentina, ironically only 6 miles from the Chilean border. And they pledged to put $2 to $3 billion more into developing those properties. The market responded to these apparently rash board-level moves by driving the value of the company down to 35% of its previous value, though it has since recovered to the 54% level. It's no surprise that many Montanans heard echoes of the past, fearing that Stillwater was traveling the same path that led to Anaconda Company's disintegration. Was Stillwater disinvestment in Montana inevitable unless there was some shareholder intervention to change the company's direction? Would ACM's historic mistakes be repeated by Stillwater, leaving Montana, its workers and their families, as victims? According to news accounts, those historic parallels were in Governor Schweitzer's mind and on his lips as he left office in January. He spoke of the ACM parallel as he led the Clinton Group's successful shareholder effort to assert new boardroom control at Stillwater. Now, at the conclusion of the shareholder battle and with a new board, Stillwater has refocused on its core Montana properties. Montanans are breathing a sigh of relief. Montanans like the sons, daughters, and grandkids of smelter workers in Anaconda, who will never forget the closure of the giant smelter on September 30th, 1980, crushing their economy. Like the descendants of refinery workers in Great Falls, who remember the refinery closure that same day and the demolition of the Great Smokestack just 2 years later, again crushing their economy. And folks here in Butte know that when the Berkeley pit was closed and the underground mine water pumps were turned off, the inexorable rising of acidic water in the pit began, toxically demonstrating the take-the-money-and-run mentality that drove AZM executives as they destroyed Montana's industrial giant, forever destroying the thousands of Anaconda jobs. As for Stillwater mining, the Schweitzer-Clinton Group intervention appears to be producing positive results. The new company board includes a Montanan, Schweitzer, for the first time in a decade, and his chairman for the first time ever. The Stillwater board and management have pledged to focus company investments on its Montana properties. The company's stock value is beginning to rise. The voices of the past have been heard. Perhaps 30 years and some concerned and insightful leadership have made a difference. We may not be condemned to repeat history. This is Evan Barrett at Highlands College of Montana Tech in Butte, thinking about the future. Thanks for listening.
Evan Barrett is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Sarah Jovetich.
And I'm Courtney Anderson. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.